So we've talked a lot about cost over the years, and there are so many things that we can do to address better cost in terms of quality outcomes, in terms of lean efficiency, in terms of taking better care of our patients so they don't readmit. But if we don't address monopoly and or monopolistic pricing power, either on the plan side or the provider side, we're actually not going to get to the root of costs in healthcare.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult, painful conversation for us to have. But I think that is where our conversation is likely headed in the years to come.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pop Health Podcast. This is your host, Zach Morgan. Our guest today, DJ Wilson, founded State of Reform just after the passage of the Affordable Care Act as a safe space for policymakers and the private healthcare industry to come together to ask quote-unquote stupid questions to understand each other's operating realities. Since then, the State of Reform conferences have become known for their high-caliber speakers and cutting-edge informative topics. Please stay tuned till the end of the episode when DJ offers a discount code for any registration to State of Reform conferences in your area. As always, thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
So, DJs, we'd like to start each episode. Can you tell the audience something that they might not know about you, maybe a fun fact outside of work?
Well, I don't know if it's a fun fact outside of work, but it's an interesting fact, which is my wife and I work together. And not everyone can do that, but we are able to do it, thankfully. And so Kariana, my wife, comes from a background where she ran a physician group as the COO, CFO, and IPA, and they were taking risk before it was cool. And I worked in politics, and so we got together and of course got married, and we've got three wonderful kids. And actually, I think that's relevant to the conversation because State of Reform is in some ways a reflection of that, sort of bridging this gap between a more healthcare-centric space and a more political space and figuring out ways to communicate with one another. So it starts with my wife.
Yeah. And are you located in the Pacific Northwest?
Mm-hmm. Up in Seattle.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Excellent. Is that kind of where the genesis of all this started? Was her IPA group up there? Or have you recently relocated up that direction?
No. I started the firm, our organization, in 2004. Our first State of Reform conference was in January of 2011. She joined in 2012. She actually didn't even attend our first conference. wasn't involved in any way. In March of 2010, the Affordable Care Act passed, and we were working with a number of organizations across really the Western United States, including California, and a lot of those folks said, you know, now that we have fought the fight to get the bill passed, we really need a place where we can come together and figure out how to implement it. Yeah. And, you know, a place that is sort of safe from, you know, Facebook posts talking about death panels, which at the August of 2009 really inspired a significant amount of vitriol and pushback and candidly some misinformation, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we wanted to have a safe place where the policymakers could come ask sort of, quote, stupid questions, where the sort of private sector, the market actors, the healthcare organizations could come ask their own sort of stupid questions about how policy works and gets implemented and really try to find a place where people could come together and talk about how to do the work of making policy happen.
Yeah. And so with all of that, what is your background?
It's varied. The consequence of finding no one that would actually hire me. I went to Gonzaga University, went and got a master's in international economics from Johns Hopkins University, lived abroad in Italy for a couple years as part of that education, worked for Ron Wyden, U.S. Senator from Oregon back in Washington, D.C., And then worked on a series of political campaigns, mostly, in fact, all Democratic, mostly Democratic. I'm one of the few people that has the scars of both having worked for Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah.
There aren't many of those people anymore. But worked for Senator Cantwell and Al Gore back in the 2000 campaign. And then tried to get out of politics a little bit and started teaching at the community college level. That was great. Ran for office a couple times myself, lost, won, then lost again. Finally said, I'm not doing that anymore. And in 2004, started our company. And we started doing some consulting work and had been sort of mostly in that space up until we launched State of Reform in 2011. Also started a coffee company, actually. I was roasting out of my garage for a little while, a big 5-pound commercial roaster, and then had a couple of coffee shops and restaurants and then sold that. So, you know, that's what you do when no one will hire you. You just got to figure it out.
Well-rounded.
Yeah, that's one way.
I actually attended Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles. So we are West Coast Conference rivals, although rival is a loose term because we don't hold a candle to Gonzaga, especially in basketball. So
yeah, well, and my friends from Gonzaga would, of course, correct you on the pronunciation, but we'd also respect the fact that LMU was a real powerhouse in the 80s.
That's right.
Back before anyone knew where Gonzaga was on the map.
So. Yes. Long before I attended, unfortunately. But yes, we know you well.
Yeah.
And so with all of your background, especially on the policy side, what specifically began to interest you about healthcare policy?
Yeah, it's not a lie to say I met a chick in a bar.
Yeah.
My wife. I mean, candidly, I had purposely tried to stay away from healthcare because I thought then, and still believe now, that the healthcare is one of the few areas of policy where there can be very few winners. In other words, if you're working in the policy space, you can have a relatively complete awareness about most of the issues in education. Most of the issues and about how transportation works, most of the issues and how infrastructure works. But when you get to healthcare, if you're a policymaker, you will probably never be the person who has most of the answers about how it works.
Right.
And it turns out nobody in healthcare has most of the answers because everyone's deeply specialized in their own silo, generally speaking. And so I, like many folks, I think in healthcare, stayed away from it as a policy area. And then I was visiting a friend in the hospital and left that experience and was getting a drink during happy hour and met a woman who became my wife later. And
yeah.
And I was chatting with her during that sort of courtship period and in our early days of our marriage and was saying, look, you've got a really interesting, compelling story to tell at your company. You should tell it. You should connect the dots between what's happening in federal policy discussions about what's happening on the ground in the state and about the work you're doing at the IPA she led. And so that was sort of the genesis of my awareness about how disconnected each of those really were. For as much energy and money and time that goes into making healthcare work, as you know, as our listeners know, like the left hand and the right hand seldom are in communication with one another.
Right. And so you obviously have started the company and State of Reform. Is the company itself called State of Reform?
Yeah.
It is, right? Okay. And so what are the goals of the organization or what is the mission of the organization?
Yeah. Great question. It is by design somewhat actively passive. And by that I mean we see our goal as being a dispassionate, objective convener of as many different parts of the healthcare sector and spectrum as possible, getting them together in a safe place where they can learn from one another without feeling like they're getting set up for anything.
Right.
You know, where they can build what we think of as social capital, that sort of connective tissue across silos that we don't really have a place to aggregate and develop anymore. We don't have a lot of it. You know, Rotaries are still active. Chambers of Commerce are still active, but they're not quite as centrally important as they were maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago in terms of fostering social capital. We're in that sort of age of social media now. So we try to create that place, and other organizations do that to some degree, like a hospital association does a great job, or the California Association of Health Plans does a great job with their conferences and convenings. But those are, by definition, generally silo-specific.
Right.
or organizations, maybe progressive organizations that, for instance, support universal access or single payer in California, they get folks together. But those are often really advocacy oriented. They are subjective. They have a worldview, and they're trying to educate and mobilize based on that worldview. So there are very few places where you can be where they are policy agnostic, where they are entirely nonpartisan, and yet still have the credibility of getting everybody in the room. And so that's our mission, is to try to find a place where we can get everybody in the room for that day. And then for the other 364 days of the year, continue to seed the conversation through digital media tools like podcasts, web content, email, video, social media, et cetera, so that the conversation continues in a different kind of format, but one that we're all now very familiar with consuming.
Yeah. And you do actually have a podcast. Well, we were just talking about this as well. And it includes some of the conversations from the conferences, but it also advances some of these same topics, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our State of Reform podcast there are two components to it. There are reflections and recordings of the sessions that occur at some of our conferences. And there are also conversations with folks that are kind of living in this space in between the public sector and the private sector. So, for instance, we just sat down with Martin O'Malley for 45 minutes, former governor of Maryland, and talked about what they did there. That is truly one of the more innovative state-level innovation programs and models in the country. He wasn't allowed to talk about it very much during the campaign for a host of reasons, mostly related to the media wouldn't give him very much airtime to talk about it. But we were able to talk about it at length for 45 minutes. And so State of Reform, really, like its name, tries to focus on state-level policy, featuring and sort of giving a platform to some of the more innovative, more thoughtful, really more inspirational ideas. And so we see that at our conferences, but we also try to capture that in our podcast.
Yeah, and that's a great leeway into where are you currently operating or looking to expand these conferences and kind of the scope of your business too?
Yeah, we are growing. We thought that there were probably a lot of great events like State of Reform that were policy agnostic and nonpartisan. It turns out there are not.
Yeah.
And that if you live in this space, you probably have a national event. But healthcare is local, and relationships are local, policy is local, regulations are local. So we have built these local regional events in 9 markets in 2017, and we're expanding into 3 more in 2018. So we host them in Seattle, Portland, Spokane, Anchorage, Honolulu, Sacramento, LA, San Diego, and Austin. And we're going to expand into Denver, Phoenix, Salt Lake City this year, and maybe Dallas. We'll see.
Yeah. So that's 6 or 7 states or going to be in that range. It's obviously hard enough to keep up with the politics and constant changes within, you know, one state. What approach do you take to be able to wrap your head around like you said, it's local, to wrap your head around the ins and outs of each individual state's healthcare policy debate?
Well, a couple of reasons. Like I say, we're in 6 states in 2017. We'll be in 9 states in 2018. I think there are a couple of things. One, we sort of have to approach every state like it's a foreign country. Mm-hmm. You know, when you show up to Germany or Kazakhstan, we sort of recognize that, generally speaking, if it's your first trip, you may not speak the language, you may not know the culture, you may not know the history. There are a lot of stuff you don't know. So if you make assumptions thinking that you have all the answers about how Kazakhstan works,
right,
or how California Medi-Cal works in California, or how Medicaid works in Honolulu, if you make assumptions, you're probably going to be wrong, and it's not going to end well for you or the effort of trying to build relationships. So we approach it like it's a foreign country, A. B, it is always different, but the issues are always very similar. So states across the Western U.S. are all trying to figure out how to manage their Medicaid spend. They're all trying to figure out how to innovate in the Medicaid space. Increasingly, it's becoming apparent that market leverage is the primary driver to cost, particularly on a per unit basis, at least in terms of pricing. You know, that's happening in every market. Some markets like Alaska are highly provider consolidated and have some provider supporter, or I guess policy that supports providers. In a state like Hawaii, it's very much plan consolidated and with some policies that support plans. And so once you kind of figure out how to learn the language, learn the culture of each of these different systems, you know, we sort of helps us get down the path a little more quickly. And then I just add that C, it takes a great team, and we've got a great team that, you know, is tracking this stuff across each of these states. And D, the thing is about healthcare, it's so heavily regulated that there's a lot of public information.
Right.
And so as long as you can access the public information, know where to find it, and, you know, take the time to read it, you can learn a lot of stuff just by reading the public record.
Yeah. And so just to go back to one thing that you said while you were talking about some of the policy debates, you mentioned that it's becoming increasingly more apparent that a lot of the cost is driven on kind of a per unit basis. Can you just expand a little bit on that for some of the listeners and why it's becoming more apparent?
Sure. So I think the most prominent study on this point came out in 2010, and it actually came from the Attorney General's office in Massachusetts. The Attorney General at the time was Martha Coakley, and she produced a study that said 75% of price is determined by market leverage and 25% of price is determined by cost. And that general framework has been studied since 2010 and been found to be the case in a number of examples and number of studies. And it reflects, I think, the knowledge of most people who work in the plan provider contracting space, which is if you have monopoly power, either on the purchasing or supplying side, you're gonna set prices. And it's no surprise that it works in healthcare that way, because that's how it works in the rest of the economy. So we've talked a lot about cost over the years, and there are so many things that we can do to address better cost in terms of quality outcomes, in terms of lean efficiency, in terms of taking better care of our patients so they don't readmit. However, if we do all of those things, that is a reflection in many ways of how really poorly the healthcare system has done at managing cost. But if we don't address monopoly and or monopolistic pricing power, either on the plan side or the provider side, we're actually not going to get to the root of costs in healthcare.
Yeah.
And that's a very difficult, painful conversation for us to have. But I think that is where our conversation is likely headed in the years to come.
Yeah. So we hear so much about individual mandate or employer mandate. But while obviously it seems like that plays into it, it seems like what you're talking about is actually a little bit of a different idea there. Is it directly affected by the requirement to hold insurance, or is it a larger issue than that?
I think that the requirement to hold insurance, whether it's an employer mandate or an individual mandate, is generally speaking good for downward cost pressure. In other words, by expanding the risk pool to healthier populations, by requiring that more people have it, that is generally speaking a good thing for cost. In other words, it's going to lower cost. However, if you add benefits, I think that's also good for costs, because it generally speaking will keep people healthy. But if when they need services, those services are so expensive, it doesn't matter. It's so expensive that it's going to lead people into medical bankruptcies.
Right.
It actually doesn't matter whether there's an individual mandate or an employer mandate.
Right.
That sort of thing is sort of like deck chairs on the Titanic,
generally. Sure.
So, you know, those are good policy outcomes or policy initiatives. Washing your hands at a hospital, like
right.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, people weren't even washing their hands,
yeah, right?
Right. And so you'd see hospitals that have a little thing up on the mirror, like, don't forget to wash your hands.
Right.
And that has led to great outcomes, and that has reduced costs by lower readmissions. But that's a deck chair on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Really important to do. Also not going to get at the heart of cost issues.
Yeah. And I think to kind of move along with that, a lot of those are pushed by political agendas in the back, and because they make for good taglines a lot of times. You mentioned that you put a focus on being policy agnostic. Why is that so important for your organization and for your conferences?
You know, everybody's doing this for generally the right reasons. I mean, we don't ascribe malice or anything other than charitable sort of intent to anybody. We think this is just the natural course of the American political system, where you bring your interest to the democratic process, you mobilize your voice gets heard, your voice gets turned into political and policy action. That's normal. But we do have a tension between the individual good, or the special interest, and the common good, or the general interest. A lighthouse is something that I'm not going to ever be able to afford to build a lighthouse. But it's in my interest that a lighthouse exists so that ships can come in and bring goods to market. And because they don't crash on the shoals of the beach, the goods I purchase are actually lower cost. Vaccinations. Turns out that if everybody else's child is vaccinated but mine isn't, or I vaccinate my child and somebody else doesn't, that there's a free rider benefit to the child that's not vaccinated if everyone else is taken care of. And in healthcare, we have kind of this, I'm getting off, I think, maybe the point of your initial question, but we have this natural and purposeful part of our democratic process to go advocate for our interests, and that's good. But we also have to be aware of how sometimes our direct narrow interests can be in conflict with the overall general interest and the common good. It's not to say that we should stop advocating for our narrow interests. We should continue to do that, but we should be informed by the broader narrow or the broader general interest. And so the idea of our policy agnosticism at State of Reform is simply that we want everybody to continue doing great work advocating for their own interests and issues, but we'd like them to be as informed as possible about why their issue, narrowly defined, impacts positively or negatively the general interest. Because sometimes we all have to chip in and build the lighthouse, and we've all got to sacrifice a little bit for the common good. And so if we forget the general interest, then our special interest becomes antithetical to our republic.
Yeah. Is it difficult as you go from state to state to stay policy agnostic, or does that happen more on the deliberate scheduling of speakers and of certain guests?
I don't think it's difficult to stay policy agnostic. I would say two things we are thoughtful about in that regard. One is, when it comes to speakers, we have so many speakers in a one-day event that we sort of crowdsource our content in that way. And that way, no entity can be perceived as sort of biasing the totality. If everybody's got a credible opportunity to speak, then, you know, it kind of takes on this sum that is greater than its component parts. And that starts with our convening panel, which is likewise full of a diverse group of folks. Pretty much anybody that wants to participate, that is active and wants to contribute to the broader conversation, can. And our agenda and ultimately our speakers fold out of that. The other thing I'd say is, particularly as it relates to our digital content, the emails that we write, that I write, that the stories that we post, we take the position that, A, sometimes people in the media will say, this side is off by 10, that side is off by 10,000, they're both wrong. And we think it's important today in this era of media to say 10,000 is more wrong than 10.
Right.
So that people understand the difference between 10 and 10,000, you have to elevate that. And so that doesn't mean that we are being less policy agnostic. That means we are being empirical. Right. 10,000 is greater than 10.
Right.
But that is in some conflict. Some people don't think it's, you know, don't see it the same way. The other thing I'd say is, B, we try to show our work, meaning if we come to a conclusion about something, we try to show our logical construct as to why we got there. Mm-hmm. And we welcome people telling us our logic's wrong. We try not to just say, oh, the sky is blue, without saying, I looked outside, I asked five people, we looked up,
right,
you know,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So if you show your work, I think people will trust you more. And then C, I'd say, judge us based on the canon of our work. Sometimes we get a story, we think it's logical. We look back 6 months later, we were wrong.
Sure.
But if you judge us by the complete canon of our work, our aspiration is that through the totality of our reporting, analysis, and commentary, you'll see that we're policy agnostic, notwithstanding the fact that 10,000 is greater than 10.
Sure, sure. I've attended a few of your conferences now, and I always enjoy going to, there's usually concurrent sessions where state leaders, whether they be state senators or state congressional members, from one party speak, and then typically the next session from the other party speak. And I'm always struck by the fact that they can be discussing the exact same topic and see it through entirely different lenses. Do you find that that's fairly indicative of the way that healthcare policy debate is going right now?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly, generally speaking, today, the left and the right see the world through very different lenses. But that has been the case in health policy for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I have often said that I think solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is easier than solving American healthcare. Because at least in Israel and Palestine, they know they have different languages, they have different cultures, they have different histories, and that when one side says martyr, the other side says freedom fighter. In healthcare, the oncologist comes from a very different history, culture from the long-term care worker. And it turns out they do have different languages, but they all speak English, or, you know, they speak the same language, whether it's Spanish or English or whatever it is in the room. But they speak a common language, but they use the words to have different meaning. So Medicaid to an oncologist might be a negative. Right. It might be something to avoid.
Right.
Whereas to a long-term care worker, it's a central part of it. If you're taking care of kids, Medicaid is centrally important.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, if you're a pediatrician, that is a specialty. But in that case, the specialist really is interested in Medicaid as well. So the idea is that we don't even have a common lexicon in healthcare to be able to bridge these gaps.
Sure.
I think you see that population health is a great term, like the word population and health both mean widely divergent things based on who you're talking to.
Yeah. So at the conferences I've been in, I would imagine at most of them or all of them, you typically moderate kind of the main panel of the morning, kind of first thing or early in the morning. How do you approach that from conference to conference? How do you approach your role because you don't pull punches, I will say, when you ask questions. I've been pleasantly surprised even sometimes about your frankness in asking questions of whether it be political leaders or organizational leaders on the stage. How do you approach that?
You know, I candidly think, like I, you know, some people say, well, imagine the audience in their underwear. I imagine our audience as being around a big dinner table.
Yeah.
And having a really good dinner table conversation with wine and food, and everyone's relaxed and having fun. And we all know kind of what the issues are. And we wouldn't maybe talk about it during professional hours, but now that we're all friends here, we've all had this great meal. What do you really think?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I try to frame it, you know. And at the dinner table, it's nobody's intention to like make someone mad. It's nobody's intention to throw them under the bus. It's just like, can we set aside the sort of talking points and get right at it?
Yeah.
Tell me what you really think about X. And so that's my aspiration, is that people feel like they're being part of an intimate conversation that doesn't usually happen in a professional setting.
Yeah. And so from, you know, month to month, it seems like some of the main not main distractions, but some of the breakoffs from the healthcare policy debate kind of consume the national attention for a little bit until the next one comes up. But over the years, what do you see as the real main challenges that have really lasted on the arc through the debate, the debates that you've had from conference to conference and from state to state?
I think, you know, I mean, generally speaking, they are some version of cost, quality, and access, right? And those vary, but I would say, maybe answering the question a little differently, the things that I'm sort of acutely interested in now, particularly in California, I think this CinerMed meltdown, where the MSO construct, this is a little bit too acronymy.
It's okay. Yeah. Can you just, for the listeners, MSO?
Yeah. An MSO is a management services organization. They are often the administrative entity that an IPA, an independent physician association, will hire. An IPA is often a group of docs that wants to take care of their patients. They want to take some risk to do that, meaning they could lose money, they could make money, but they need to coordinate the care of their patients. And so to have that administrative infrastructure to support the care coordination, they hire an MSO to be the administrative entity.
Right.
And in Southern California, in LA County, but down San Diego, up in Fresno, you've seen the beginning stages of some of that MSO construct melting down, where docs have perhaps ceded more control than they thought to administrative entities, or not managed that as well as they should have. And so you're seeing the DMHC, the Department of Managed Healthcare, now issue cease and desist orders for at least one of these MCOs or MSOs, excuse me. An MCO is a managed care organization,
right,
health plan.
Right.
And there are at least two others that are, you know, on the rocks. And so I'm told that there are even more. This is potentially going to upend 30 years, 40 years of a model in California that has worked for better or worse. It's how it has worked. I'm not saying it's been effective or efficient or couldn't have been worse or better. I'm just saying this has been the model. And so maybe differently than your question, I think right now in California healthcare, that is a powerful story that is sort of beyond the view of most folks,
right,
but it is reshaping California healthcare.
So for those that might be listening, what kind of impact would that have on the average layperson that maybe gets their healthcare through these organizations?
Mm-hmm. It depends.
Could it have, I guess? It's speculative, but.
Yeah. I think in LA County, for instance, LA County has two primary Medi-Cal plans that then have subcontracting relationships. One is LA Care, one is Health Net. LA Care, for instance, is also in the individual market there. They're a Medicaid plan, a Medicare plan also for seniors. Health Net is likewise. I'm not sure if Health Net's on the exchange there, but they are a Medicare plan also. So in a place like LA County, LA Care will no longer contract with some of these IPAs that have MSOs.
Right.
They'll contract with physicians directly, and there won't be much of an impact there for the consumer. In a place like Fresno, where there are fewer physicians, less access, and the physicians that are there have wanted to have an IPA to provide this sort of overlay, an administrative overlay to help support managed care. With that managed care overlay going away, and without a strong sense of a strong level of engagement from MCOs there, it's possible that some of those Medi-Cal beneficiaries could lose significant access in that market. So I guess the short answer to your question is it varies based on region. Mm-hmm. And those regions that have low numbers of providers are always going to struggle with access, but it's going to be a little bumpy for a little while.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the different lenses that both sides of the aisle see some of the issues through. I remember specifically one of my favorite kind of examples of that from one of your conferences was hearing both panels talk about the lack of access in some of the more remote areas in California. And on the, you know, GOP side, it was because of the Affordable Care Act. And on the Democratic side, it was because we haven't expanded the Affordable Care Act enough. Do you see that general theme running across states as well? Or is that more specific to California because we have this more robust exchange?
No, I think it's definitely something that we see run across states. And I'd say that both perspectives are accurate. Plans are leaving geographic areas because they are not able to get contracts with providers, or the contracts that they get are too expensive, so the plans can't be successful financially, or that they just don't have enough administrative capacity to manage that geographic bandwidth, so they are leaving. On the other hand, if every plan, if there were more support for expansion into those regions, then there's a lot of ways that could happen. If there were perhaps more options for plans to get in, or even fewer options. One way to solve some of this stuff is to let one Medi-Cal plan have a given region, or one exchange plan to have a given region, and not offer any competition.
Yeah.
So there are ways that by expanding the basic premise of the Affordable Care Act, you actually could solve some of that access issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's part of the challenge. Both sides are right.
Right. And you were talking about, you know, from this discussion, you were talking about the MSOs who are managing some of the Independent Physician Association, the IPA's administrative work there. We've actually had Don Crane on, who's now the CEO of America's Physician Groups. They just changed it. So we actually talked to him just a little while ago, again, after they changed their name. And he and his organization feel really strongly – they obviously represent those IPAs. They feel very strongly that capitation is the way of the future, with obviously some changes there, but that's really what's going to drive change in healthcare. Do you see that coming up as a common theme more often, that capitation is going to kind of be the way forward from where we are right now?
Well, I think the role of Don Crane, I think he's been a smart and savvy leader for California and California healthcare for a number of decades now. I do think that capitation is sort of, you know, it is the construct, the financial construct that appears to be most effective at bringing financial risk for good behavior and therefore financial benefit for good outcomes closer to the patient-physician relationship. That said, I think there are a lot of ways to do that. Certainly, you can do that from the plan to the IPA or delegated group down to the patient. But I think Kaiser's model is another kind of capitated model. It just removes the IPA level.
Right.
You could, in theory, do that with a place like Sutter that has its own plan. Sharp down in San Diego, hospital system that has its own plan. Also, they're the largest individual market plan in San Diego County, for instance. So you don't necessarily have to have a capitated relationship, but any place where you close the gap between the financial incentives for quality health and the patient-physician relationship, narrowing that gap is where you'll see the best success. And CAPG's members, excuse me, American Physician Groups, or America's Physician Groups members do that.
Yeah. One thing that I do also like about the conferences that you have is you don't shy away from more controversial guests or topics that have been more taboo, like the legalization of medicinal marijuana, or I attended at the last conference a session on the opioid epidemic, things that people maybe are starting to talk about but haven't been part of the main conversation. How does your organization approach that or those topics, or deciding which ones are should be talked about, or maybe which ones are maybe a little still too taboo or out there to discuss in a professional setting?
Yeah, I think we first talked about opioids, I think, in one of our conferences in 2013. So it's maybe still 2014, but it's been something that we've been sort of featuring for a while, because through this convening panel process where we get, you know, 20 to 25 folks in a room, and then we rely on them through email and phone calls and sort of one-on-one conversations. These are the folks that tell us, like, here's what we really should be talking about. And then once we kind of come up with those topics, we sort the topics in our topical agenda to make sure that everybody in the healthcare spectrum has something to do during that day. And in other words, we have 12 cohorts that we specifically think of and identify in our planning process. You can imagine them, they're hospitals and pharma and HIT and insurance companies and provider clinics and elected officials and state agency types and so on and so forth, right? And then so we look at our topical agenda and we say, okay, here are some really great ideas for content. How do we have at least two things for every one of those 12 cohorts that directly speaks, two topics that directly speaks to each cohort throughout the day? And then something that indirectly speaks to them at all points during the conference, so they stick around, they don't drop in and leave.
Right.
And that might mean that we have a diversity. It definitely means we have a diversity of topics. And some of them might need to get framed a certain way so that they apply to a broader group than just one cohort. And then we go try to find speakers. and we think of our speakers as sort of the blind men and women around the elephant, that they all know what they know really well, but they may not know what's right next to them as well. And so rather than have a debate, kind of a tit for tat thing, we get a diverse set of speakers on the panels. And a lot of times we'll have really interesting panel topics that no one will volunteer to speak for.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're recording this just almost in February. We're late January, and our Sacramento conference is coming up April 26th. Our convening panel meets today right. for that event. And this CenterMed thing, this MSO IPA thing, is a very consequential policy and market topic. And a lot of people are interested. A lot of people want to hear what's going on. I bet no one wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, I mean, and were you there in our lunch? You were there in our lunch conversation in San Diego,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
Where John Bacchus from LA Care and uh-huh. Don Crane from America's Physicians Groups, John used the word fraud.
Right.
And Don was like, well, let's not, And so that was, you don't get that kind of conversation very many places. And they were right up there at lunch keynote. Going right at it. So it was good.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one that I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for the behind the scenes conversations. That was a fiery topic. But I do also think that's what separates a lot of your events from other places, that they're not afraid to confront some of those things head on. What do you find that people in the feedback that you get from the conferences that you put on specifically, what do you find that people tell you that they take away the most from it? Is it policy knowledge? Is it best practice? Is it just hearing other sides? What is the feedback that you get that people take the most away from?
I think it varies. Every one of these markets, because everyone is different, turns out our conference experience is always different. But I'd say generally speaking, it's the opportunity to network with people who are their peers in terms of title or organization, but never get a chance to hear from one another, yeah. right? So like brokers just don't hang out with chief medical officers very often.
Right.
And county mental health directors, even though they're political or public sector, don't hang out with state legislators very often.
Yeah.
And so that's usually the thing that people will say, gosh, I these people work in healthcare all day long and I don't know them. Yeah. I need to get to know them.
Right.
So
one thing I wanted to ask you about too on some of the new innovations that you try to talk about at your conferences. How do you approach technology in the discussions that you have at your conferences or new technologies?
Yeah, I'd say maybe two ways or two answers to that. First, we approach it like anything else and we try to get tech infused into our agenda. Interestingly, we found that a lot of times people who are really excited about technology don't understand why they should talk to a healthcare conference.
Really?
It's amazing. That's not the case with everybody. But, sometimes people who are in tech are really excited about their tech and they forget about, what the tech is supposed to be used for.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the second point, which is we don't want to create a platform for a sales job for anybody. So when it comes to technology, we want a platform for somebody to come in and say, here is a means to a greater end.
Yeah.
And so as long as they've got a clear vision about the end and can talk about the connective tissue of their technology,
yeah,
that's fabulous.
Sure.
But somebody who comes in and is like, I have the best widget maker, the best EMR, right, we're going to solve everything, the best right. app. There are other places those guys can go.
Yeah. And I always find it interesting at your conferences and the breakout sessions that they're allowed to speak for, 30 or so minutes. And then there's always supposed to be 15 minutes or so of conversation at the end. And some have gotten more interaction and some more heated than other conversations. But do you find that there are certain topics that consistently are going over their allotted time just because the discussion gets so lively?
It really is dependent on the panelists.
Yeah.
When they do a great job, they get great engagement. Or when they maybe are less than candid, they get called out.
Sure.
Sure. But it is one of our central kind of constructs is that in a 45-minute session, 30 minutes is divided between the panel participants. So if you have three panelists, you get 10 minutes each. That's not rocket science. Except for they're usually – used to much more time.
Right.
And so we say, look, man, if you can't figure out how to say something high value in 8 to 10 minutes, maybe you don't have anything right. of value to say.
Right.
Then the last 15 minutes, as you said, we leave for audience Q&A because we tell our panelists, look, this whole room is a room full of experts.
Yeah.
So let them engage in the conversation too. It's not just about you speaking
right.
to the, you know, to the masses, so to speak. It's part of that, but it's also part of making sure the masses can speak back.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a mini TED Talk, but with interaction afterwards. So hopefully people are intrigued if they haven't been to one of your conferences yet. You mentioned a conference in California, but what events do you have coming up in the near future?
Yeah, good question. So we have a conference coming up in Sacramento in April. We're going to do a Denver event in May. And then for the summer, we kind of hibernate a little bit.
Sure.
And then we do again in September, we start with Los Angeles and Spokane. And in October, we do Anchorage and Portland. And then we're off to our regular schedule.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. And if people are interested, where can they learn more about the conferences, about your organization, find the podcast, those kinds of things?
Yeah. All of that's at State Reform, where we also list our events and we list our podcasts and our videos, stateofreform.com, okay. Or at State of Reform for our Twitter handle. And I would also say, this is sort of, you know, and thanks for you guys doing this, that we'll create a discount code that is 20% off, and the discount code is just 24 hours.
Oh, great.
And so anybody who listens to the podcast who wants to register for one of our events, that will be a code that transcends all of our conferences in 2018. So everybody can get a few bucks off for listening to your podcast.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And so as we kind of wrap up here, and again, thank you for your time. I really appreciate appreciate you taking some time to meet with me. But We've had a pretty wide ranging discussion about where healthcare policy is going. As people listen to this podcast, where should people be looking positively at where healthcare is going right now? Because a lot of the discussion seems more doom and gloom.
Yeah, I would say maybe my answer is a little bit of both. There is a vacuum and a deep yearning for policy leadership on healthcare that is constructive, that is based in really sound, credible argument and logic, that is informed by the actual practice of healthcare, and that is empathetic and sensitive to consumers and patients. There's a deep yearning for that. And your listeners, the people in healthcare who work in healthcare every day, those are the people that can develop that. They just have to have the courage to step out. And I know that's easier said than done. And I know that everybody takes, you know, brave steps in their works. Not everybody, but many people, your listeners, take brave steps in small ways. But having a concerted, positive vision for changing California healthcare or healthcare in any of our communities, and it doesn't have to be California wide. It can be in your local community.
Yeah.
That is more needed now than ever, but the consequence of that action is more magnified than ever. And so the flip side of that, I'd say, is maybe some people are new to healthcare since the Affordable Care Act. A lot of people are. Some people might be new, you know, in the last 10 years, but people who've been working in healthcare before the ACA, man, back in the 2000s and 1990s and 1980s, people would say, you know, we ought to do something about healthcare.
Yeah.
Like, we don't do anything, you know, and there was this sort of stilted period where there was no real movement.
Yeah.
And now we got movement going all over the place.
Yeah.
And the need for even more leadership. So now is the time that many people have waited their whole careers for, an opportunity where there is movement and there is an openness to political and policy and market leadership. And so this is the time we've been waiting for.
Yeah. So get out there and do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, DJ, thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you bet.